This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Hey, it's Todd, your host for this edition of the News Roundup. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is constantly changing, and things might have changed by the time you hear this episode. Stay up to date with the news by listening to your local NPR member station and by visiting npr.org for all the latest. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show. You're listening to the 1A Podcast. I'm Todd Zwillick, and it's time for the News Roundup. Let's start with the election milestone we passed this week.
And there it is. Joe Biden has the necessary delegates to win the Democratic nomination on the first ballot. To the extent there was any remaining suspense, it has been eliminated.
Meanwhile, the nation's leading senator says it's time for new leadership in Israel.
I believe a new election is the only way to allow for a healthy and open decision-making process about the future of Israel.
With us, Arthur Delaney, senior reporter at HuffPost. Arthur, as always, great to see you.
Great to be here.
And back with the show, Margaret Talev. Margaret is Axios senior contributor and director of Syracuse University's Institute for Democracy, Journalism, and Citizenship. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Great to have you. Taylor Popolars is here. You know him. He's national political reporter for Spectrum News. Hi, Taylor.
Hey, Todd. Good to be here.
Great to have you all. I'm so glad that you're all in the studio here today. We've got a lot to get to this hour. It's been happening all over the country. We're going to start with the news out of Georgia just today and the sprawling criminal conspiracy case against Donald Trump and more than a dozen co-defendants in Fulton County. So for weeks, that case has been in kind of a sideshow. Defense attorneys wanted to disqualify Fulton County DA Fani Willis for conflict of interest because of a romantic relationship she had with another prosecutor on the case. His name is Nathan Wade. So Judge Scott McAfee has ruled that Fani Willis can stay on the case, but only if Nathan Wade withdraws. We're going to talk about other news from this case, but this is the breaking news. Taylor, what else does Judge McAfee's ruling say here?
Well, it means that the case will move forward, and the timeline that could have been significantly delayed well past the election in November, that will not happen. We still don't have an exact date for when this trial will begin, but it means that Fani Willis, as the district attorney, will be able to stay on the case, but she will likely have to dismiss her lead prosecutor, Nathan Wade. This was a very dramatic couple of weeks of testimony. We saw Fani Willis react very kind of frustrating. She was very frustrated when she had to take the stand and kind of explain her relationship and explain how it didn't impact, in her view, this sprawling case that she and Nathan Wade had led.
And so, all on television.
All on television in very kind of Trump dramatic
fashion. Just how you
fashion.
Want your relationships to play out.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible because it's very rare to see a district attorney who's leading a case have to take the stand to defend why they should continue to lead that case. So this is technically a win for her because she can stay on the case and it can move forward and they don't have to start from scratch. But she does now have the public aware of all of these details,
right,
and her lead prosecutor will have to go away.
I mean, Margaret, Fani Willis can stay on the case. The office of the district attorney isn't sidelined, which would have completely derailed this case. But side benefit, if defense lawyers wanted to drag the prosecutor through the mud and have the public aware of disparaging information about her, they succeeded.
Oh, yeah, for sure. This is everything you wouldn't want to happen if you were prosecuting the case of your life. But I think that the takeaway at this point now is there were efforts to get all the charges dismissed. Some were dismissed, most were not. So on that front, there's still a very robust number of charges in the case that will go forward.
So the judge earlier this week dismissed six charges out of dozens and dozens. This is a sprawling RICO conspiracy case.
Correct.
Dismissed a total of six charges, three of which apply to Donald Trump. But the big case, I mean, the meat of the case remains, right?
The meat of the case remains. I mean, we're talking about the case against Donald Trump. There are several co-defendants. You know many of their names, Rudy Giuliani, Mark Meadows, John Eastman. And they are still facing charges around state racketeering and around filing false documents. There is still a robust prosecution of Donald Trump and his associates for conspiring to overturn the state election results in 2020. Those charges that got dropped are charges that will be familiar to people. You remember the infamous call that was made with Trump to Brad Raffensperger, the Republican Secretary of State, where Trump was telling him, just find the votes. Mm-hmm. That the charges around that and some other pressure, alleged pressure campaigns around the guy who was then the State House Speaker and members of the State Senate, those are among those three charges against Trump, and three others are the overall counts that got dropped. But the what's interesting to note about that is that prosecutors can use the evidence that was tied to those now defunct charges in order to argue their overall case.
So the call is still in play. The call that we've all heard on tape, that's still evidence in the case.
The evidence around that can be used in the case, and the prosecutors, if they want to, have the ability to refile the actual charges that got dismissed. I mean, McAfee's argument was not that the charges were bogus. It's that they didn't make the case the right way. He said that the counts in his words, contain all the essential elements of the crimes. But he said that they failed to make sufficient detail in the allegations and to make the case for the underlying felony, that they basically also failed to give the defense the ability to argue or to defend themselves. So they're saying if you want to come back with those charges, you can refile them, just make them in a way that that meets the standard or the threshold. Or if you don't think that you need to, just go ahead with the other counts and you can still use some of the evidence around these counts to go forward. So that's going to be a choice for the prosecutor in terms of timing. They have 6 months to refile those charges, but if they wait 6 months, they're going to go past November and that could be problematic.
Well past, and the chances of this sprawling case going to trial before the election seem pretty small, although the judge has not set a trial date in this case yet. There are still 14 co-defendants in addition to Donald Trump. Let's draw a line under Fulton County there, at least the case, because Fulton County still important this week. As we heard at the top of the show, both Joe Biden and Donald Trump passed the threshold to be their party's nominees for the race this week. That was expected. I think we heard the voice of one analyst saying everybody kind of knew this was coming. Of course, Joe Biden is the nominee. Of course, Donald Trump is too. Taylor, you were in Fulton County, right? Not on the Fannie Willis case per se, but you were there on the politics of both Joe Biden and Donald Trump in Georgia with speeches and rallies. What did you pick up from voters? And then I want to talk about Donald Trump and what he had to say too.
Yeah, it was interesting to be there. Trump and Biden held dueling campaign rallies. Biden was in the heart of Atlanta, and then Trump was about 75 miles northwest in Rome, Georgia, which is in Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene's district. So a very conservative area. Trump had over 3,000 people show up for his rally. Biden's campaign intentionally kept his event much smaller. I would say it was about 150 people, invited guests only. And they both kind of offered their pitches. It was like the kickoff to the general election. What was interesting is I interviewed about 15 people, I think, over the course of 2 days, just about the race, what they were paying attention to. For Trump supporters, all of them waved off all these criminal charges that he's facing, both in Georgia and in the three other cases. Many also insisted to me that he actually won in Georgia in 2020, even though we know that he lost by just under 12,000 votes. So they're all operating in kind of a being motivated by all this pushback they feel Trump is facing on the criminal front and then on the election front.
You're saying motivated by an alternate reality, yep. Motivated by the idea that Trump actually won Georgia. Let's not let that slide. That's false.
It is, and completely false. Georgia's elections are run by its elected Republican election officials. There were three recounts in 2020 that showed that it came out to just under 12,000 votes over and over and over again. Very limited cases of fraud, no widespread fraud at all. And still, time and time again, I think I spoke with eight people at the Trump rally who are all Georgia voters, and they insisted to me that they did not believe those numbers and that they were motivated to turn out for Trump because they feel this last election was stolen from him. So that was just really interesting to hear. On the Biden side, there was a lot more broader kind of support for the president and his legislative agenda. And several voters at this invite-only event also did bring up their concerns about the future of democracy, which is something we hear Biden talk about a lot. While in all my travels in the last year, I haven't met a whole lot of people on the street who say, yeah, I think about democracy each day, and this is, you know, what's motivating me. There is a core to Biden's base that is really motivated by that, and they view Trump as kind of a threat to that.
So more broadly, Arthur, on the election, we're back in Georgia. But more broadly on this, there's this sense of here we go again. There's this sense of the rematch that nobody wanted. Two incumbents. Nobody's very enthusiastic about either of them, at least in the broad middle of this country. But I think that actually obscures something very, very important. Not a same old, but the stakes of this election when you compare the two candidates. When you actually go back, and I encourage people, if you can, to go back and watch Donald Trump's rally in Georgia and the things he had to say. The sort of same old obscures the fact that the stakes are very high, and Donald Trump has proposed to suspend the Constitution in his favor. He has said that on day one, he'll release all January 6th defendants and so on.
That's right. And in 2016, in 2020, Joe Biden made democracy the theme of his campaign, only it was about Charlottesville. And now we've had January 6th and Donald Trump making it pretty explicit that he doesn't really abide by our constitutional norms and practices and would have more experience, you know, more lackeys who'd be willing to do what he wants in the government.
We're going to return to the election. We're going to turn to events on Capitol Hill around President Biden, special prosecutor, and many others. So let's draw a line under that. We're going to take a quick pause here, but we'll be back with more of the week's biggest headlines in just a moment. Stay with us.
This message comes from Capital One, presenting sponsor of the 2024 Tiny Desk Contest. Earlier this year, unsigned musicians from around the country submitted their original songs for the 10th annual Tiny Desk Contest. The panel of judges are hard at work picking standout entries, and you can follow along and choose your favorite videos as well. The winner gets to play their very own Tiny Desk concert, then headline a tour with NPR Music this summer. Want to come along for the ride? Visit tinydeskcontest.npr.org to learn more, then check out the Venture X card from presenting sponsor Capital One. Earn unlimited 2x miles on everything you buy and turn everyday purchases into extraordinary trips. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
All right, we're going to head to Capitol Hill because there's no way around it. Age is a concern for Joe Biden. We heard from a lot of 1A listeners this week, and it would appear that the Biden campaign is leaning in to the idea of their candidate's age, but also his experience.
Look, I'm not a young guy. That's no secret. But here's the deal. I understand how to get things done for the American people.
That's the campaign spin there. You can hear the jaunty violin music, very lively and full
so
of vigor,
young.
Of course. That's the latest campaign ad from Joe Biden. But here's another moment from this week where his age took center stage.
My task was to determine whether the president retained or disclosed national defense information willfully. That means knowingly and with the intent to do something the law forbids. I could not make that determination without assessing the president's state of mind. For that reason, I had to consider the president's memory and overall mental state and how a jury likely would perceive his memory and mental state in a criminal trial.
That's Robert Hur, the special counsel who investigated President Biden, fiercely defending his assessment of the president's mental state that he concluded in his final report into Biden's retention of classified material. So, Arthur, you were there. What happened at this hearing? What was the actual point of asking Robert Hur to be there on live TV?
Republicans wanted to highlight the possibility that Joe Biden had committed crimes and the fact that Joe Biden's old, and there had been all this hype that Robert Hur was a right-wing ideologue who had resigned from the Justice Department the day before so that he'd be unbound by their rules regarding discussing the case. And it turned out that Robert Hur was totally boring. And Democrats and Republicans would try to get him to disparage Joe Biden or Donald Trump. And all he was there to do was say, well, that's not in my report. And then if they asked him that something was in his report, he'd say, yes, that was on page 47 of my report. So it was really a dud and a wash because Robert Hur was not willing to go there with lawmakers trying to make him make disparaging comments about either of the candidates for president.
The big deal in Robert Hur's report that said there wasn't enough evidence to prosecute Joe Biden was not only did he talk about the president's memory, but he used terms like, I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember exactly, a kindly old man with a foggy memory, something like that, right? That a lot of people on Biden's side saw as just completely disparaging and outside the bounds of what a special prosecutor should be doing.
Adam Schiff, Democrat from California, really went after him for that. It said, you knew that this was gratuitous, that this would be pouring gasoline on a fire in our political moment. And Robert Hur just kept saying, well, the law says I had to write a confidential report to the attorney general. And Schiff kept remembering, you knew this would be public. You knew it, which, of course, he did. But I think Hur, because he wasn't charging, did have to disparage the president to keep the Republicans at least somewhat off his back, because they were so mad that Joe Biden is not being charged with the crime. They think if Donald Trump's charged with the crime, it's only fair for Joe Biden to also be charged, regardless of the fact that the cases are completely different. And so everyone was yelling at her. Nobody really got anything great out of him, and it was basically a wash. Because of the State of the Union, the age thing had been partly diffused, I would say. Because Joe Biden, you know, showed up with some vim and vigor and thought on his feet.
On the age thing, just finally, I mean, the big episode that was part of this that people will have heard was Hur's allegation that Joe Biden couldn't remember the date of his own son's death, Margaret. And that got batted around over and over. I just have to say, in watching this, I feel like that whole debate obscures something that we all know to be completely true. And I say this not to defend Joe Biden in any way, but really to knock through the partisanship of this issue. My own beloved grandmother died right around the end when I was in college. I remember we buried her on my birthday because it was hot out and I was born in July, and I'll never forget being at a funeral on my birthday. I don't remember the year. I can only narrow it down for you to about three to four years. That's how memory works. That's how my memory works. And I feel like this drilling down on he's so old he can't remember his son's death is a little misleading, more than a little.
Think if Joe Biden was, you know, 50 and that happened, it would probably be interpreted as a grief-stricken parent, and grief does things to cloud and twist your memory. But because Joe Biden is three decades older, and because voters see that he moves with shifting his feet, they hear that his voice is different than it used to be. And those are, you know, human cues that if you ask voters who are not particularly partisan who they think seems old, they say Joe Biden seems older than Donald Trump. But you put those two things together and it turns into an age argument. I do think that this Hur's testimony did not really move the needle for anyone except for Robert Hur, who came out looking more professional than people had alleged he was before. Democrats tried to get her to say that the report exonerated Biden, and he came out and said this report did not exonerate Joe Biden. So Democrats didn't get the soundbite they wanted. Republicans didn't get the viral moment they wanted. And in the end, somewhere between the State of the Union address and how voters see Joe Biden every day at the podium on the road, they're going to make their judgment about his age and his fitness to serve.
And in many ways, the State of the Union address seems to have drawn a line under that, at least for Democrats, if you read their reactions and their coverage. All right, age to the side. Let's get back on policy and aspirations, because the president released his budget on Monday, fiscal year 2025 aspiration. It's $7.3 trillion in a budget proposal that includes about $3 trillion in deficit reduction over a decade. Taylor, as I said, presidential budgets are aspirational. They're not law. They're wish lists. What does Joe Biden want to do if he's reelected?
I think it's important to zoom out. And I always tell people when this news cycle comes up every year, it's that this truly doesn't really matter, because it's just the president and his team saying, here's our wish list. And Congress usually says, OK, that's great, but we're going to continue kind of in our divided path forward. So this is truly, it's almost an extension of what President Biden laid out in his State of the Union. You know, you think about policy issues that he talks about, like expanding the child tax credit and trying to help people who don't have that strong of a financial foundation and trying to lift them up. That's what his budget is looking to do. And this budget proposal, while the White House will say, oh, this cuts the deficit by $3 trillion, Republicans, before they even had a chance to fully read it, they were out criticizing it and saying this is the latest example of Democrats wanting to, you know, to have federal government take over everything and they want to drive us further into debt. So it's always interesting to cherry pick and look at, because a president can use this budget proposal to spotlight the agenda items they would love to see Congress prioritize, even if Congress won't, i.e. the child tax credit in this case. But it really is going to go nowhere. Every week, as Arthur can definitely attest to, we are at risk of a shutdown, and we're trying to see if lawmakers can reach a deal beyond just extending funding for another week or two.
Arthur, the president at the State of the Union proposed tax increases on the very, very rich. And then just a couple of days later, Donald Trump was asked about Social Security and started to riff on it and said, well, there's lots of ways you could think about cutting it, before he said a bunch of other stuff.
The Trump comments about Social Security, I did a story on it, and the headline had to say he suggested cutting it, but it was an incoherent ramble. And speaking of age, Donald Trump struggles to make a sentence, and you couldn't really infer what cuts he had in mind. And then the campaign later this week clarified that he would always protect Social Security. And yet Trump still used the word cutting in there, but with regard only to waste or fraud. What waste or fraud in Social Security? What are you talking about? Is it a totally vacuous, unspecific statement about Social Security that the Biden campaign seized on, because they know better than to use the word cutting when they're talking about Social Security? And they have all these proposals to fix up its long-term budget shortfall using higher taxes. And that was the big contrast that they have tried to draw between themselves and the Trump campaign. There's a huge tax deadline where all these household tax policies expire at the end of next year. Joe Biden would only preserve those for people with incomes below a certain threshold. Republicans want them all, regardless of the impact on the deficit. So there actually is a huge policy debate looming that is reflected in the aspirational budget documents we saw this week.
Let's leave Capitol Hill and talk about another issue that's bound to be big in the campaign going forward. According to a new book by CNN anchor and national security analyst Jim Sciutto, our colleague, Donald Trump praised Adolf Hitler as someone who did, quote, good things. That's according to a conversation between Trump and his second White House chief of staff, John Kelly. Kelly resigned as Trump's White House chief of staff in 2018 and has become a public opponent of Donald Trump ever since then. Arthur, as shocking as these revelations are for a presidential candidate, this isn't the first time Donald Trump has praised dictators, although I do feel like this sort of Hitler did good things kind of goes beyond Trump's normal affinity for the Viktor Orbans and the Kim Jong-uns of the world.
He praises dictators in public all the time. He calls them his friends, geniuses, strong. It's bizarre. But to have it, as if a curtain is being lifted, and here's what he says in private, and for it to be about Adolf Hitler, yes, that is a little bit different and a bit shocking. But it's a very consistent pattern with Trump. He's always done this. He loves authoritarians. He aspires to be one.
It makes me want to ask Margaret, how important a role are Trump's former staffers, former aides, John Kelly, former chief of staff? So many of them have said in different ways that he's unfit to serve, from former Secretary of Defense, chief of staff, and others. How important might these individuals be in a campaign?
So far, they have not been significant or a turning point in terms of the way Trump's base views him. I think in terms of swing voters, it's possible that they could be. But look at the long collection of people. It's not just John Kelly. It's two of the Republicans who were running against Donald Trump for the nomination, Chris Christie and Nikki Haley. Chris Christie's support numbers inside the Republican Party are now tiny after his decisions to go after Trump and the way he's done them. And Nikki Haley, ran an opposition campaign as long as she could inside the primary. But her arguments also have not been deeply persuasive to all outside of the kind of band of traditional pro-business, security hawk, Chamber of Commerce, like kind of the old Bush 1 and 2 brands of the Republican Party.
Well, in a close election, even if that's a narrow band, it could be a very important one. And we'll see going forward how important Trump's closest aides
yes,
are
those
to that
folks plus the women in the January 6th hearings, I think, also.
Could you imagine if a string of Joe Biden former cabinet officials came out and said he's so old, it's a danger to the republic.
No,
he'd be toast.
And it's because the bases of the two parties operate differently. And if Trump's argument is I'm an outsider, don't expect insiders to like me, it insulates him in a different way from if you were running to preserve the establishment. There are two different sets of rules, two different sets of standards. It's confounding and very frustrating for Biden. But that has been the reality of the way this has played out. Trump says something completely over the top, and voters bake in that he's going to say something over the top, and so they don't react the same way.
It's certainly true for Donald Trump's base, whether it's true for that band of national security-minded, traditional independent Republicans, it may matter deeply. Okay, that's the campaign. Let us move down to Florida, where a key witness in Donald Trump's classified documents criminal case, referred to in the indictment as Trump employee number 5, has now come out publicly for the first time. He did an interview with CNN this week.
And did you have any time, any idea at the time that there was potentially U.S. national security secrets in those boxes?
No clue. No, I had no clue. I mean, we were just taking them out of the Escalade, piling them up. I remember they were all stacked on top of each other, and then we're lifting them up to the pilot.
That's Brian Butler, formerly known, as I said, as Trump employee number 5, speaking with CNN's Caitlin Collins in an interview this week. Butler worked for Donald Trump for over 20 years at Mar-a-Lago. He told CNN that he helped move boxes containing classified documents under Walt Nauta's instructions. Nauta is one of Trump's personal aides and is also charged in the case. Margaret, it's rare for a key witness to come out publicly in an ongoing case like this. Why did Brian Butler do this now?
Very rare. His explanation has been that he didn't really believe that he was going to stay anonymous. He figured his name was going to get dragged out there anyway, and he wanted to be able to tell his story and not have other people characterize him. Basically, much like Trump and all of the rest of us, he wanted to control the narrative. His comments so far are bad for Trump, given everything that he's saying. But the question is speaking about it publicly going to help Trump and going to help Trump lawyers, both by giving them a preview of what he could say on a stand or in a deposition, and by giving them ways to poke holes in any future testimony if there are any differences between what he said in that interview and what he might say later?
Taylor, Brian Butler said something shocking in that interview. He said that he was driving a car where an Australian billionaire, Anthony Pratt, got in the car, and that Pratt got in the car and said to his chief of staff, two United States top secret submarine secrets that he had just heard from Donald Trump. So said it to his chief of staff and in the earshot of the driver, Brian Butler. Makes one wonder how many times over how many foreign nationals or how many places around Mar-a-Lago this has happened.
And this has been reported widely over the years. Mar-a-Lago is this fascinating place where you have to pay a very expensive membership to then have full access to then-President Donald Trump, now former President Trump. And we know that he wanted to, in many ways, show off the glories of the job.
And investigators have said that Pratt may have repeated those submarine secrets to as many as 40 people after hearing them from Donald Trump. All right, we're going to take a quick pause here, but we'll be back with more of the week's biggest headlines in just a moment. Stay with us.
This message comes from Capital One, offering commercial solutions you can bank on. Now more than ever, your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services, all tailored to your short and long-term goals. Backed by the strength and stability of a top 10 commercial bank, their dedicated experts work with you to build lasting success. Explore the possibilities at CapitalOne.com/commercial, a member FDIC. This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Amgen, a biotechnology pioneer leading the fight against the world's toughest diseases such as cancer, heart disease, asthma, and osteoporosis. In a new era of human health, Amgen continues to accelerate the pace of change, operating sustainably and drawing upon deep knowledge of science to push beyond what's known today. With each decade, they reliably deliver powerful new therapies to patients. Learn more at Amgen.com.
Let's get back to the roundup. A lot of news out of aircraft giant Boeing this week. What do we know about the death of a whistleblower who worked at Boeing? John Barnett was found dead last week in Charleston, South Carolina. The local coroner's office said it appeared to be from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Now, Barnett was in the middle of being deposed in a whistleblower retaliation case. He'd claimed that managers were pressuring workers not to document potential defects in the manufacturing process of Boeing aircraft. So, Margaret, Boeing has been taking a lot of heat lately, given some high-profile problems in their in-flight scares and manufacturing shortcomings. Can you tell us a little bit about the context of this whistleblower, John Barnett's death?
I mean, yes, he was a high-profile whistleblower. That lawsuit in which he was being deposed had to do with his accusations that Boeing had been retaliating against him. And his lawyers have said that he was in good spirits just before he was found dead, and that they had no indications that he planned to take his life. So this is under investigation. In the meantime, what is important to know, and this is making big headlines now, is that he had reportedly told a family friend earlier, when he was still alive, that if he were to be found dead, not to believe it if anyone said he had committed suicide. So this has added an awful lot of spotlight to this case, and it's made the investigation really important.
His family put out a statement, too, though, that said that becoming a whistleblower had taken a toll on him, and that they did not sound as though they thought this was fishy.
Interesting. Well, the Federal Aviation Administration said on March 4th that, quote, a six-week audit of Boeing and Spirit AeroSystems prompted by the January 5th incident involving a new Boeing 737-9 MAX aircraft found multiple instances where the companies allegedly failed to comply with manufacturing quality control requirements. This is talking about the story that we all saw and heard about, Taylor, when the door blew off mid-flight on a Boeing 737-9 MAX. What consequences is Boeing facing now?
Well, there's obviously these new federal probes, and there's just kind of constant press about all these issues related to Boeing aircraft. Just earlier this week, there were 50 people injured by a flight that was going from Sydney to New Zealand suddenly just dropped in midair. It didn't crash, but
lots of people were injured.
Yeah, it was a sudden enough drop to injure people, especially when you're moving about the plane. Maybe the fasten seatbelt sign was off. There have been just several instances, emergency landings, a tire falling off after takeoff. I fly pretty frequently, and you're reminded how safe flying generally is, especially compared to driving or if you like to bicycle around the community that you live in. But when there are airline incidents like this, they get a lot of attention because of how safe it generally is. And a lot of these recent worrisome incidents have been linked to Boeing, and there's all these either whistleblowers or there are kind of documentations of people saying, hey, I tried to wave a flag and maybe it was, you know, put under the rug or something. So it's concerning, and it'll be interesting. Congress especially has a knack for getting very involved when airlines are involved, because most of these lawmakers are on planes multiple times a week, and they and their families care a lot about it. So it'll be interesting to see kind of what happens down the road.
I mean, we talk about consequences. The most immediate one is Boeing's stock price, which if you watch this week, I would call it a descent.
It's down 11% this month.
Yeah.
Hitting them where it hurts.
Enormous, especially for a manufacturing giant like Boeing. Let's leave that story and our hopscotch flights all over America jumping around, because now we jump back to Washington, but really to the whole nation and the Republican National Committee. Because Donald Trump and his campaign officially took control of the Republican National Committee on Monday. More than 60 people were fired after former North Carolina RNC chair Michael Whatley was elected chair, and Donald Trump's daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, was elected co-chair last Friday. Now, both Whatley and Lara Trump strongly embraced conspiracy theories that the 2020 election was stolen. It wasn't. Taylor, what does Donald Trump's takeover of the RNC mean for the party?
I mean, it means that for months, Trump has been viewed as this presumptive nominee. He's now succeeded in not only clinching that title, but he now has a much larger infrastructure supporting him and kind of backing up both financially, politically, infrastructure-wise, everything that he wants to pursue in the coming months. There's also the fact that he's facing a mountain of legal bills that continue to pile up. And while Michael Whatley and Laura Lee Trump have insisted, oh, we're not going to use the National Party to fund those, there have been discussions about that, and that's been a concern from people who on the outside who say that wouldn't be a great merging of resources, especially while the RNC has been struggling with fundraising. But then you have party leaders who are saying the former president needs all of our help and he needs this is a political problem as much as it is a legal problem.
Donald Trump has melded his legal problems with the campaign, saying they're coming after me to keep me out of office and the rest of it. The Republican National Committee already has helped pay his legal bills and his lawyer bills and some for some of his allies. This has already happened. If potential donors think that this is the way going forward, that your donor money to the RNC goes to Donald Trump's lawyers and legal bills, is there a fear that this puts downward pressure on people's desire to support the party?
Well, the concern is whether the concern for the Republican Party is whether they have enough money to dedicate to other key races.
Not just Trump, in other words.
Correct. They're trying to hold the House. They're trying to take the Senate. And so that requires cash. And defending Donald Trump is requiring, as you can see, a lot of cash because of all the various indictments and counts. And so I think follow the money is the right way to think about the story. It's completely normal for an incumbent or the president or the party's nominee or an ex-president who's going to be the party's nominee to control the party, whether it's the RNC or the DNC. That's pro forma, whether or not you're ousting old folks or just bringing in new folks. Like, if you're the head of the party, so you should control the party. The question is, what could they get with this new leadership structure that's even more loyal to Donald Trump than Ronna McDaniel, who was quite loyal? What could they get with new employees and the new leadership?
I mean, part of the question behind the scenes is how much pressure is the leader of the party, Donald Trump, going to put on the RNC to help pay his bills, whether it's a good idea or not?
And now this is the RNC. And so I think that is what distinguishes this from just – this is not just about, like, are you loyal to Donald Trump or will the actions of party leaders help Donald Trump? They already have for many years. But bringing the family in, both literally and figuratively, I think has a lot to do with the financial strategy in those decisions.
All right. That's the campaign. If we dip back into Capitol Hill for just a moment, there was major legislation on the floor of the House this week, Congress weighing in on whether to put TikTok at risk of a ban. An estimated 170 million Americans use TikTok, according to the company. And on Wednesday, the House of Representatives passed a bipartisan bill that would force TikTok's owner, which is ByteDance, based in China, to sell the company or face a ban in the U.S. if they don't sell. Here's Republican Congressman Representative Mike Gallagher, one of the bill's sponsors.
One being the security of Americans' data on the platform, but the other, and I think broader concern, is the potential for this platform to be used for the propaganda purposes of the Chinese Communist Party.
So I was looking around and doing some research, Arthur, on this. There's actually precedent for a forced divestiture like this. The popular LGBTQ app Grindr was Chinese-owned up until 2020. A sale was forced. They did sell. Grindr still in the app store, as popular as ever. There is precedent for making this work, at least in a practical sense.
Yes, and Congress could really do this. It passed with 350 votes in the House, which is an extreme blowout, and there's plenty of Senate support. It's just a question of whether it gets put on the floor. TikTok brought all its lobbying power to bear on this vote. It put a banner on the app and had kids calling Congress, and it totally backfired because they were leaving messages like, if you ban TikTok, you know, I'll jump off a bridge, or I learn more from TikTok than I do from school. And I heard from one source who said a lawmaker who was undecided voted in favor of this because of this pressure. So they were not their best advocates there.
Just to stay on TikTok for a moment, Margaret, Donald Trump, he had a complete reversal on TikTok this week. As president, he tried to ban TikTok. He had an executive order that was shot down by the courts. Now he says he's against the ban. It's a full 180 for reasons including kids love it. Also, if you ban TikTok, it would be good for Facebook, and I don't like Facebook.
Yep.
Do we actually know the reality of what explains Donald Trump's complete reversal?
The politics of this have been so interesting, and ABC News had some good reporting on a major potential donor who is TikTok-aligned, who Trump might be courting because he needs money, just like we talked about in our previous conversation. I think there are all kinds of currents and cross-currents going on here, but the Trump-Biden dynamics on TikTok are politically really interesting. Trump, as president, was very critical of TikTok, as you know. The Republican Party and Donald Trump have been sort of very hardline on China. But now Trump is against the TikTok ban, partly, I think, because he has his pulse on the electorate and he understands if Biden is weirdly both on TikTok and anti-TikTok, that will hurt Biden with young people. And I'm not sure young people will vote for Donald Trump, but if they can see that contrast, it may keep them home and not voting for Biden, which is what he wants. Then there's the Steve Mnuchin, Trump's former Treasury Secretary, now saying he thinks that legislation should pass. He thinks TikTok should be sold, and he wants to put together a consortium to buy the group. There is this TikTok story is going to keep driving a lot of the conversation the next few weeks.
Before we wrap up, I'd love to know what stories you're going to be following this week. So, Margaret, let's start with you.
Thanks. Axios and Harris Poll doing really interesting polling this week on the vibes, kind of a gut check on college campuses. Two top line findings. I'm going to be watching how these impact support for Biden. More than 2/3 of college students now saying universities should protect free speech, even if that extends to physical threats or inciting violence. And the second finding, and that's really profound, and the second finding is that there is massive bipartisan support among students for government loan help, the kind that Biden promised and then couldn't deliver because Congress blocked him. In real life, you see Republicans much more wary or critical of this than Democrats. On college campuses, whether you're a Republican student or a Democrat, you want the government to help you.
And Biden has tried to do that loan relief in little bits and pieces of legally acceptable chunks of loan relief that he can accomplish.
Say not enough, not fast enough.
Okay, Arthur, go ahead.
Next week, Republicans will have an impeachment inquiry hearing. They're still trying to impeach Joe Biden, even though they haven't found anything on him, and it looks like it's going nowhere. But this hearing's happening. They invited Hunter Biden. He said he won't come, but he's full of surprises and has crashed hearings before. One of the other witnesses is currently in federal prison, so will he join via Zoom? I don't know. So I'm going to be there for that.
And this is after federal prosecutors have charged the key witness at the bottom of this case with lying to the FBI and have also said he's a Russian agent.
It's a whole big mess.
Taylor.
We talked a lot about Trump's legal issues, and something I'm watching, it's ever day to day, we're trying to figure out when or if any of these trials will start. We just saw for the New York hush money case, which was set to happen on March 25th, that the attorney there, the DA, said, oh, I'm okay with a 30-day delay. We're waiting to hear from the federal judge in Florida for the classified documents case to say, will this happen in May or will it get pushed further? And we were talking about the Georgia case, which we still don't have a date, but we know that the district attorney, Fannie Willis, will likely oversee it now. So that's going to be a major impact on this election, whether or not these trials happen before November.
Whether any of them go before the election, the smartest money is still on the Manhattan DA and the Stormy Daniels hush money / election interference case, 34 felony counts against Donald Trump. Well, my thanks to Arthur Delaney, senior reporter at HuffPost, Margaret Tolliv, Axios senior contributor, and Taylor Popolars, national political reporter for Spectrum News. We'll be back with the global edition of the News Roundup in just a moment. Stay with us. We've got a lot to get to.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor E-Trade from Morgan Stanley. Take control of your financial future with E-Trade. No matter what kind of investor you are, their tools and resources can help you be ready for what's next. Now, when you open an account, you can get up to $1,000 with a qualifying deposit. Terms apply. Learn more at etrade.com/NPR. Investing involves risks. Morgan Stanley Smith Barney LLC. Member SIPC. E-Trade is a business of Morgan Stanley.
Let's get into the week's biggest international news. Joining our panel today, Amy McKinnon. She's national security and intelligence reporter at Foreign Policy. Hi, Amy. Thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
In London, Nina Marie Potts is the director of global news coverage for Feature Story News. Great to have you as always.
Thanks for having me.
Then Alexander Ward is here in the studio as well. He's national security reporter for Politico and author of The Internationalists, The Fight to Restore American Foreign Policy after Trump. Alex, thanks for being here.
Yeah, always happy to be here.
Okay, we have a lot to get to, as I said, and let's start in Haiti, where the acting prime minister, Ariel Henry, has announced his plans to resign. The announcement comes after Caribbean leaders, along with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, met to discuss the crisis in Haiti, where gang violence is now running rampant. Henri has been stuck in Puerto Rico, unable to enter Haiti due to threats on his life. More than 200 gangs are estimated to be operating in Haiti now. It's over 80% of the island country's capital of Port-au-Prince is under gang control. Gangs have forced Haiti's two international airports to close and have launched attacks on the country's prisons, freeing more than 4,000 inmates. We've been covering the crisis in Haiti in detail here on 1A. Amy, Henri says that he's going to resign once a transition council appoints an interim prime minister. Why is Henri's exit a significant moment for Haiti now?
So depending on where you start your timeline, this is a profound crisis, which has been weeks in the making, 3 years in the making, but also decades in the making. But starting with 3 years ago, and I will be brief, as you say, we do have a lot to get to. You know, Henri takes his place as interim leader after the previous president was assassinated. Henri was not popular. There was a lot of questions about whether he was the appropriate person to take up that position, but he leads Haiti for the interim 3 years, during which time it descends into, you know, it was already a very chaotic situation.
There have been protests all this time. So yeah. Part of the question is why now, you know?
Right. Well, the why now comes from a real descent into violence and chaos with these attacks on prisons, 4,000 prisoners released, many of them gangs pretty much taking control of the capital, Port-au-Prince, as you said. It's a crisis of gang violence, but it's also a political crisis. And central to resolving this and bringing some kind of stability to Haiti is, you know, of course, is getting a problem on the gang issue, getting a handle on the gang problem, but it's fixing this political crisis, this vacuum of leadership. There's currently no elected officials in office in Haiti at the moment. So Henri stepping down and making way for a transitional council is the first in a very long road to getting to that point.
Well, speaking of leadership, Nina, the transition council that I mentioned expected to plan general elections for the country of 11 million people. When could we actually see that happen, or do we know?
That's an impossible question to answer. I think it's very, very unclear. I mean, arguably, Haiti is in transition right now. It's just not in any kind of managed transition. It's in a horrifically volatile, unstable, unpredictable state. Henri is obviously physically out of the way because he can't get back to Haiti. He went to try and get the Kenyans to go through with their controversial plan of sending a police force mission. As that trip was happening, the main gang leader, known as Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier, said that he was working with other gangs. That's ultimately what forced Henri to step down. The gang seized control and any remnants of a functioning state broke down. The finance minister basically declared a state of emergency to try and take back control. That hasn't happened. There's some indication that various alliances are forming, but all the current power, or at least 80%, let's say 80% of Haiti right now is under the control of these criminal gangs. And I think, you know, it's right to keep asking, how will the transition happen? You know, will the gangs have a seat at the table? At the moment, I think the real question is, will the gangs completely take over? Mm. You know, is there realistically any space at the moment for an international intervention from outside to stabilize conditions for a peaceful transition? And that's even before you start talking about a multinational security force.
Well, you mentioned Jimmy Cherizier, otherwise known as Barbecue, major gang leader, former police officer. He has said that violence in Haiti will only escalate if Henri does not step down.
Today, we are telling the international community to give Haiti a chance. We Haitians have to decide who is going to lead the country and what model of government we want.
Diplomatic statement from a major gang leader, Alex, in Haiti. What do we know about the role that gangs might play in Haiti's political future?
Well, they want control. I mean, the leaders of these, you know, leaders, you know, Barbecue and another guy named Gabriel Jean-Pierre, I mean, they run the G9 and GPEP gangs. They have basically formed a union to, one, oust Henri and, two, take over the country. Look, Haiti's had years, decades of gangs being connected to political parties and politicians. And in this case, they kind of want to go out and lead on their own. They are currently together going against the idea of a multinational intervention to keep the peace, right, which would be Kenya-led and UN-backed. They're saying that they could maybe perhaps keep the peace and get in charge, very much the arsonist also wanting to be the firefighter. So in this case, I think what you're seeing is these gang leaders trying to foment chaos because then they can maybe pull it back on their own and then have some say in the political future of the country. So they are fighting not only to oust the current leadership, but fighting to be in charge themselves.
Strategy, interesting strategy to draw a line under. Create the chaos, then present yourself as the solution to the chaos. This is the classic strategy of authoritarians for time immemorial. This is exactly how they operate. That's Alex Ward of Politico, also speaking with Amy McKinnon of Foreign Policy and Nina Maria Potts of Feature Story News. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, met with CARICOM, the Coalition of Caribbean States, this week and talked to reporters on Wednesday.
A transitional presidential council is being stood up. That council has as its mandate to choose a new prime minister, an interim prime minister, to establish a National Security Council, and to put in place an electoral commission. That also creates a better environment in which the multinational security support mission can go forward. I was on the phone this morning with President Ruto of Kenya, who confirmed Kenya's preparedness to lead that mission. As soon as this new council is stood up, which we believe will happen in the next couple of days.
Amy, we've heard so much about this proposed Kenyan police force, someone call it an occupying force, I suppose, to come and help restore order in Kenya. Blinken committed $300 million to the effort. It's been in the work for months. What do we know about when this mission might actually be deployed or deployed at all?
Well, it seemed earlier this month that it was about to happen. Things were lining up. The interim Haitian leader was in Kenya to sign the agreement. But then the announcement this week that he's going to step down has thrown things into chaos once again. The Kenyan Constitutional Court Kenya's High Court has intervened to say that, you know, there's no basis for this agreement anymore. And so the Kenyans are now looking for an interim government to be established so that they can conclude an agreement with them to dispatch this police force. But it scrambles the chessboard again, because to get to an interim government, you need some form of security. To need security, you need the Kenyans, but the Kenyans won't come until there's an interim government. So it kind of sets the sequencing of things back another step.
Meanwhile, the gangs in the middle of it all benefiting from the chaos and making sure that stability never happens. Well, 4 million people are facing acute food insecurity in Haiti. That's according to the UN. That's one step away from famine. And the recent rise in gang violence has displaced thousands of people beyond security forces. Nina, it makes me wonder that apart from the security forces, what commitments are the international community making to aid in the humanitarian situation in Haiti?
Just to touch on the security mission first, it's not just the U.S. and Kenya. Benin has offered 2,000 troops. The Bahamas are also committing personnel. Jamaica, and I think Antigua and Barbuda have also said that they'll help, and Canada and a couple of other countries. I mean, in terms of the international donor community and its pledges, I mean, clearly the priority is to try and get aid to Haiti, but it's impossible at the moment because the airport has shut down and it's incredibly difficult to get in. And there is a question about self-determination and whether or not, you know, Haiti and Haitian people, while welcoming aid, you know, actually in some way and on some level reject the intervention of an international force, certainly. And there are a huge number of obstacles to the money that has been pledged, certainly from the US point of view. There are questions also about the Kenyans' ability to pull a force together should they, you know, decide to pull that trigger, not just from a cultural point of view, but from a linguistic point of view, will they be able to engage and communicate? So that's one big question. And the Biden administration hasn't yet clarified how it's going to be able to distribute aid through this task force. And again, that comes back to the control of the gangs back in Haiti, but also their political aspirations and their military capacity, which is far greater. You know, they're getting weapons smuggled in. They're making money from ransom and kidnappings. So, you know, the complications are very, very extensive.
Meanwhile, as recently as Wednesday, Alex, political leaders in Haiti spoke out against this very transition plan that's backed by CARICOM. So, I mean, Nina put a finger on it. This is just... bogglingly fluid.
Yeah, we don't know what's going to happen. No one in Haiti knows what's going to happen. No one in the world knows what's going to happen. The U.S. is trying to help. Caribbean countries are trying to help. African countries are trying to help. But at this point, when you, as I said before, you've got arsonists trying to be firefighters. They're the ones who are stoking the fires and keeping the water hose behind their back. So Haiti's future is in their hands, and those are tough hands to be in.
A troubling and apt metaphor from Alex Ward there on the situation of the arsonists with the hoses behind their backs acting as firefighters in Haiti. All right, let's move on now to the war between Hamas and Israel. An update, more than 31,000 people have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. That tally comes from Gaza's health ministry. On Friday, Hamas said it had submitted a new truce proposal to mediators in Egypt and Qatar. The Times of Israel reports that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has dismissed the proposal, calling it, quote, absurd. Palestinians in Gaza started fasting for the holiest month in the Muslim calendar on Monday, and for most, food to break the fast each day is hard to come by.
There are no jobs left, no water, and no electricity. People are selling their belongings to live, and Ramadan is very hard on us. We rarely eat, whether it is Ramadan or not. And we always remain hungry.
Amy McKinnon, there are multiple international efforts underway to bring desperately needed food, medicine, other supplies into the Gaza Strip. President Biden announced plans for a pier, a makeshift port on the coast in Gaza, led by the United States. What are the biggest hurdles for getting aid in right now?
There are so many hurdles to getting aid not only into Gaza, but then distributing it within Gaza for the little amount of aid that is getting in there. So starting outside of Gaza, you have checks, right? All of the trucks going in, any aid going in is subject to extraordinarily thorough checks by Israeli forces who are concerned that there may be, you know, contraband weapons smuggled in there. And then you have protests at the borders on the Israeli side, people protesting, trying to prevent any aid from getting into Gaza. And that not being dealt with on the Israeli side. You have the Israelis are not letting aid agencies buy aid within Israel. So then they have to locate it somewhere else in the region and then bring that in. So that's just outside of the territory of Gaza itself. And that's only a small sliver of what they're dealing with. When you're actually inside Gaza, there's the challenge of distributing it. The IDF is there. It's an ongoing military operation. There was a strike this week on a food distribution point run by the UN Agency for the Palestinians, UNRWA. The Israelis said that it was targeting someone who was a senior military member of Hamas who was killed in the attack. But that just underscores the incredibly perilous situation for those distributing aid. And then, of course, after 6 months of war and limited food, people are starving, people are desperate, and these aid deliveries are just being swarmed upon. People just looking to get their hands on anything that they can get.
One thing that's a recent development are deliveries at sea, from sea. A barge loaded with food is on its way to Gaza from the Mediterranean island of Cyprus. It's the latest test of a possible maritime aid corridor. That aid is being sent in, by the way, by World Central Kitchen, a U.S.-based aid organization founded by celebrity humanitarian chef Jose Andres.
Well, we are trying to build a 60 to 70 meter jetty into the sea that will give us the option to safely download the first cargo, and from that jetty, you built a bigger one that will allow us to hopefully bring more and more boats, bigger and bigger quantities. But again, still failure is a possibility. But what we cannot do is use fail the people of Gaza. That will be the true failure, is not trying.
Chef Jose Andres there speaking to NBC's Meet the Press earlier this week. Nina, we mentioned the blockade that's been in place in Gaza since 2007. What's the significance now of this barge hopefully reaching Gaza for the first time since Hamas took over the Gaza Strip?
Well, I believe the ship has arrived pretty much off Gaza in the last few hours. It's named the Open Vessel, which is named after this Spanish charity that's supplying this aid. And it's a hugely significant moment because it's been stuck in Cyprus for weeks. It's been sailing at about 3 miles per hour through the Mediterranean. But, you know, despite the news that it's, you know, reached or reaching its destination, we can't forget, I think, the extreme and expensive expensive challenge of delivering aid this way. You know, by far the quickest and most efficient way of distributing aid would be by road over land. The UN and the EU very quick to remind the global community that the sea route can't replace access by land. We had the EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, saying that the lack of aid entering Gaza is a man-made disaster and starvation's being used as a weapon of war. The ship pulling this barge has been bringing in flour, or rather carrying flour, rice and protein. But again, aid agencies consistently saying that it's a fraction of what's needed. And just to pick up on Amy's point about the difficulties of getting in by road, we're hearing that aid agencies are trying really hard to change up the convoy routes in. That one of the issues is that the infrastructure's also completely collapsed. So, you know, so many tanks have been rolling in on those roads that there's just rubble. And it's incredibly difficult beyond, you know, all the points that Amy rightly made about, you know, checkpoints and you know, other difficulties. It's just not a long-term viable solution to be bringing aid in by ship.
Amy McKinnon mentioned a moment ago the Israeli strike on UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, at an aid point, 22 at least one member of UNRWA staff was killed, 22 injured in that strike in Gaza.
We are an international institution. All of this is for the people. We work day and night to serve refugees. It is forbidden. Look, what is this? We take this to the elderly and children. What is this?
Desperate comments there from one of the UNRWA workers in Gaza. The Israeli military, as Amy mentioned, acknowledged that strike, saying it was targeting a Hamas commander who was killed in the strike, according to Israeli officials. Well, back here in the United States, speaking of Israel, we're seeing significant signs that America's relationship with the Israeli government is changing. On Thursday, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer called on Israel to hold new elections. Chuck Schumer says Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is, quote, an obstacle to peace.
I believe in his heart he has his highest priority is the security of Israel. However, I also believe Prime Minister Netanyahu has lost his way by allowing his political survival to take the precedence over the best interests of Israel. He has put himself in coalition with far-right extremists like Minister Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, and as a result, he has been too willing to tolerate the civilian toll in Gaza.
It's Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, the first Jewish majority leader in the Senate and the highest-ranking Jewish official in the United States. Alex, what kinds of reactions have these comments gotten?
Negative ones. The reviews are in, and the Rotten Tomatoes in Israel are not high for Schumer's comments. I mean, you've had everyone from Benny Gantz, who's in the war cabinet and would probably be the next prime minister, or at least as well, a lot more popular than Netanyahu, depending on how things come out. But it would be a major challenger. He's criticized it. Naftali Bennett, a previous prime minister, has come out and criticized it. Of course, Netanyahu's right-leaning party, Likud, has come out. And a bunch of people have come out, even and Republicans in the U.S., saying this is an appropriate statement and criticizing Democrats who constantly talk about election interference, saying, hey, this is now a major Democrat basically calling for, well, not basically, legitimately calling for elections, explicitly calling for elections in Israel to see things happen here.
All that's fair, Alex, but I heard those statements. They're rare. They were unusual. You don't see Senate majority leaders or American officials commenting, calling on other countries, especially allies, to hold elections. Then again, it occurred to me pretty fast that this wasn't for the Israelis. This was for domestic political consumption, wasn't it? I mean, this seemed to be, you'll tell me if I'm wrong, aimed at Democrats who were divided over Israel and Gaza, and Chuck Schumer realizing that Democrats have a political problem at home.
Absolutely, right? That uncommitted vote that we've seen in presidential primaries across the country, to go against Biden as sort of a protest vote, not for Israel-Hamas. Yeah, this is Schumer reading the polls, seeing that Democrats are losing political steam heading into a presidential election. But at the same time, let's notice who Chuck Schumer is, right? He's always been to the right of his party on Israel, has been staunchly pro-Israel his entire life, has constantly defended Israel in these kinds of moments. And now we have him basically saying, offering a major critique of Israel. I mean, at this point, it's a green light for any critic of Israel to come out and say their piece.
Well, on Tuesday, in a video address to the AIPAC conference here in Washington, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that moving forward with a ground invasion of Rafah in southern Gaza was essential to winning the war against Hamas.
We will finish the job in Rafah while enabling the civilian population to get out of harm's way. We've taken measures to minimize civilian casualties that no other army has taken in history.
So, Amy, in a way, this brings me back to Chuck Schumer's comments calling for new elections in Israel's lost faith in Benjamin Netanyahu, because in an interview with MSNBC over the weekend, President Biden said that an invasion of Rafah, where more than a million Palestinians are currently sheltering, would be, quote, a red line. What would be the implications there if the invasion of Rafah does indeed go ahead? I mean, we should note that in the same interview, the president also quickly walked back this comment, saying that really there are no red lines when it comes to Israel and its policy. That makes me believe that, in fact, there aren't any, or he and Chuck Schumer need Democrats to believe there is one when, in fact, there isn't.
Well, to your point about, you know, who was the audience for Chuck Schumer's remark, someone said to me very early on in this conflict that, you know, for the Biden administration, it sometimes pays for them to get caught trying. And so there are kind of many layers to their policy around this. I definitely think there is a very real, very genuine appetite to mitigate the humanitarian catastrophe underway in Gaza right now. There's obviously a very real impulse, particularly coming directly from the president, to support Israel. Those two things very often in tension. But to the point about red lines, I mean, this is something which has historically got pretty much every U.S. president that has ever uttered this phrase in trouble. And if you look at Biden's comment, he said, you know, going into Rafah would be a red line, but we won't abandon Israel. And so, you know, in terms of policy, you know, the officials are not going to say what Biden would do if Israel did go into Rafah. In terms of policy remedies, I think you could, you know, see things like them conditioning some limited amounts of aid going in. But I think based on what the president said, you know, who's the audience for this, as you said?
Alex?
Yeah, one thing about the red line comment, I'm less... I don't really believe that that's the red line comment wasn't Biden saying I don't want Israeli troops to go into Rafah. His main concern about the red line was I don't want Israel to do an operation that will kill a bunch of civilians in Rafah. U.S. officials have told me, and we published on it, that they would support, they being the White House, they would support a smaller targeted operation inside the city to go after high value targets.
In other words, an anti-Hamas campaign in Rafah, not an indiscriminate civilian endangering or killing bombing campaign.
Right. Closer to like a counterterrorism operation than anything else. And so it's not like Biden is saying, hey, don't Israel, don't go into Rafah. He's saying, if you're going to go in, make sure the civilians are protected as much as possible.
All right. Let's turn now to Ukraine, another awful hotspot, which is about to get a little more help from the United States. Here's National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan at a White House press conference on Tuesday.
On behalf of President Biden, I'm announcing an emergency package of security assistance of $300 million worth of weapons and equipment to address some of Ukraine's pressing needs. This is possible because of unanticipated cost savings in contracts that DOD negotiated to replace equipment we've already sent to Ukraine through previous drawdowns.
Now, of course, that emergency funding comes as a $60 billion congressional aid bill for Ukraine awaits approval by the House of Representatives, stuck in limbo, still hasn't had a vote. Republicans so far are opposed to sending additional aid to Ukraine as the full-scale invasion by Russia stretches into year three. Alex, we just heard a bit from Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor. How is the White House able to send this aid while the debate continues to rage on Capitol Hill?
They seem to have found some money in the couch cushion. And in effect, that couch cushion is there are some differences. There were some misspending or at least some miscalculations in an army budget. It's honestly unclear. And you've seen all the reports often of like, oh, and the administration now found an extra couple billion because of a miscalculation of the worth of so whatever weapons. Anyway, the administration's argument here is, look, this is not going to be the norm. We just happened to find this money. That's why we're going to send more artillery. And they didn't announce it, but there's going to be versions of mid-range attack-ems, right, which will carry cluster bombs atop them. So that's going to go to Ukraine. But the administration is saying, look, that's pretty much it. This is all we got, unless they find another couch and more money within it. But this is pretty much it, and the money needs to flow now through the National Security Supplemental, which you saw Speaker Mike Johnson recently say he's willing to put up as sort of an individual vote, which might get support, but he'd basically separate Ukraine and Israel funding as part of that. So who knows how that will actually turn out.
Well, Nina, earlier this week, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban said in an interview that former President Donald Trump promised to, quote, not give a penny to Ukraine if he's voted back into the White House. Nina, why was Orban meeting with Trump now at this time in the first place?
Well, I mean, for a start, for Trump, it's a rare sign of support from an EU leader, and he has a mate in Europe, but he also had this message to deliver through Orban. I think the realization that a second Trump presidency would mean no more money for Ukraine at all has been slowly dawning on Europe, and it's a bit like watching a kind of cold, hard nightmare become a very likely hard reality. There's been obviously a lot of urgency to Ukraine's appeals for funding, but there's also been a lot of denial in Europe, with the optimists insisting that Ukraine can survive this war, almost as if it's possible on bits of funding and kind of willpower alone. And I think Trump's message through Orban has really solidified the fear that you know, even if this $60 billion package were to come through, that's it. There's nothing else. You know, Trump saying very clearly on the campaign trail that a top priority for his second term is to bring the Russian-Ukrainian war to an end, clearly not in Ukraine's favor. But he hasn't been as explicit as he has been recently, and certainly through this message in Orban, he's become a lot more aggressive about demanding that Europe burden the costs of this war, that it's not for US taxpayers. So his position has hardened. I think one of the interesting aspects of the Orban-Trump relationship is that while they appear, you know, united on kind of their values, their cultural values, their social values, and on Ukraine and Russia, they do have divisions over China. And that may be, you know, sort of the crack in the relationship, because the Hungarian leader takes a very different approach, welcoming Chinese investment and economic opportunity.
Well, speaking of being opposed to Vladimir Putin, it's been risky for a long time, no matter where you live. But less than a month after opposition leader Alexei Navalny died in a Russian penal colony, Navalny's longtime chief of staff was attacked outside of his home in Lithuania. His name is Leonid Volkov. He was attacked with a hammer and tear gas. That's according to Navalny's spokesperson. Volkov has lived in self-imposed exile from Russia for at least 4 years. Amy, your thoughts?
You know, Putin is riding high. I've spoken to a lot of foreign officials this week who are in town from Europe, and they point to the fact that, you know, Navalny is dead, his main domestic opposition, Ukrainians, you know, U.S. aid is stalled on Capitol Hill. The Russian military is rebuilding, regrowing at a pace way faster than any of us expected. Their economy is expected to grow this year. He's looking comfortable. But one thing of my conversations I had this week, which stuck in my mind, I had lunch with Estonia's two top intelligence chiefs on Wednesday, and they said that, I mean, I will preface this by saying there is no wave of dissent expected ahead of the elections. But if and when that day does come in Russia, we likely won't see it. No one has ever succeeded in predicting mass unrest in Russia or any kind of mass shock like that in Russia. So that's just something that sat in the back of my mind about when that moment comes, if and when it comes, we also won't see it happening.
Something very important for Americans to remember in what Amy had to say. While Donald Trump, through Viktor Orban, is promising no aid for Ukraine, while Republicans on Capitol Hill oppose $60 billion of aid, and by extension, Congress dithers, Vladimir Putin is rebuilding, and Vladimir Putin is riding high. So these things definitely matter. All right, we'll draw a line under Ukraine and Russia until next week, I'm sure, because we want to make sure to get to news out of India. On Monday, the Indian government announced that it would enforce the Citizenship Amendment Act. It was originally passed by Parliament in 2019, but it hadn't been implemented until now. This act expedites citizenship for Hindus, Buddhists, and Christians, several other groups experiencing religious persecution in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Bangladesh. But Muslim victims of persecution in neighboring nations will not be eligible for expedited citizenship in India. When it first passed, the act set off weeks of nationwide protests. So, Nina, why is Prime Minister Modi enforcing this 5-year-old act now, at this time?
Well, just a quick mention that we're expecting an announcement tomorrow on the date of the Indian election, which is a lengthy affair. It lasts for about a month. It's a huge process. But on this particular Citizenship Act, a quick reminder about India's religious diversity. There are about 200 million Muslims living in India. It's the largest minority group, and they have consistently faced discrimination in things like employment and education. And they've often been the targets of communal violence. Modi's government and the ruling party have moved much further towards limiting Muslim rights. And, you know, part of this comes through this fast-tracking citizenship for non-Muslim migrants from neighbouring countries. Hugely controversial law. The thing that stuck out for me, and this is through talking to our reporters on the ground, we've got bureaus in Mumbai and in Delhi, while there were huge protests back in 2019, this time around, the reaction has been a lot more muted generally. We've seen some protests in Assam and in Tamil Nadu, but I think there is a great deal more fear in the face of the Modi machinery, especially ahead of the election. And, you know, clearly it's the latest move in Modi's efforts to escalate Hindu nationalism. I think one interesting aspect in watching the Indian election is that we keep looking for signs of setbacks in Modi's pursuit of a third term. In reality, you know, like a lot of authoritarians, his immediate victory is pretty much all but certain. What's much more interesting is looking at what cost his policies will have much further down the line. You know, it's not really in question that he's going to come out of this election with the third term that he wants. But I think far more importantly is what cost to the Muslim community in India, and how will that just continue to breed resentment and backlashes, maybe not, you know, immediate, but much further along.
What Nina is pointing to in India, I think, holds true. We've said it on the show many times when it comes to the American election. Focus on the stakes, not the odds. The polls about who's up and who's down, who's likely to take office, much less important than the stakes of the election and what the incumbent or the candidate is going to do if they win. Well, speaking of those elections, as Nina mentioned, the government in India is rushing to regulate artificial intelligence ahead of the elections. The Indian government has asked tech companies to seek explicit permission from them before publicly launching what it calls unreliable or under-tested generative AI models or tools. Now, Amy, the government has had a hands-off approach to AI in the past. So what's changed now?
Well, the government says that this is coming ahead of national elections this year in India in a bid to prevent generative AI models from being used to kind of sway elections, you know, promote disinformation, sway public opinion. And there's fear about the role that AI could play in elections around the world at the moment. This is the subject of a lot of
Healthy fear, I would say.
A lot of healthy fear. Yes, yeah. Definitely not unwarranted. But I think what this... So critics of the Indian government's approach have pointed to the fact that there was a Google model a couple of weeks ago was asked, is Modi's government a fascist? And in its response, it said, the Modi government has put forward policies that have something like fascist-like tendencies, was what it said. And this gets to something which I think is a really interesting headache for strongman leaders, authoritarian regimes, is that you don't know what AI is going to spit out. You know, if you're in China and you put into an AI model what happened in Tiananmen Square, the Chinese government can't control what that model will spit out. None of us know how AI makes its decisions or how and why it says what it says. And so this is going to be a growing challenge going forward for how do they regulate these rogue models, which could say democratic or critical things.
And put strictures on the breadth of the cognition of these machines, because they can't afford, I don't think, for them to say just anything. So I think we're going to increasingly see these governments try to find ways to put up barriers and walls around the breadth of AI thinking before it spits out things that they don't like, like facts on Tiananmen Square or whether Modi is fascist. All right, let's move to Nigeria as we round out the hour here, because important news out of northern Nigeria, where gunmen kidnapped nearly 300 students from a school last week. Now they're demanding more than $500,000 to release those children. That's ransom. According to the Associated Press, President Bola Tinubu told security agencies to rescue the students while ensuring, quote, not a dime is paid for ransom. So, Alex, at least 100 of the students They're under 12 years old. Why are security forces, what are security forces doing to find these kids?
It's kind of unclear because they don't really have control over that part of the country or many other parts of the country. I mean, this is a massive test for the Nigerian government security forces, where the government has come in and basically said, look, we're going to securitize the place. We're going to make sure everything's working okay. We're going to increase the economy, right? We're Africa's most populous country. We got to be able to govern ourselves. And this strikes at the heart of that, right? It causes a major political and human drama for Nigeria to deal with. We recall that this is similar to the tactics that Boko Haram used about 10 years ago, right? Remember that. And so at this point, they see that the people who have taken the students feel that they can get a lot of money out of this. The problem is it becomes a wicked problem. How do you get the students back without real capable security forces and if you're unwilling to give money? So this could actually end up being a major crisis over time.
Well, the kidnapping comes 10 years after, Alex mentioned, Boko Haram took 275 schoolgirls from Nigeria's Chibok community. That mass kidnapping prompted a worldwide Bring Back Our Girls campaign. Close to 100 of those girls, by the way, are still missing. Nina, these kinds of kidnappings have been going on for years. Why are they still happening?
Well, they've evolved. I mean, and by the way, there are still 98 girls missing from the Chibok kidnappings from 2014. It's criminal gangs now, as Alex has alluded to. It's not so much about religious ideology, and I think there is a misperception. I mean, these kidnappings do have their root in Boko Haram, but it's turned into an industry thanks to economics and poverty. Tinubu's inability to correct course for Nigeria after years under, you know, the corrupt Buhari government, at this point makes Nigeria ungoverned, but also ungovernable. You know, there are millions of kids who are out of school. There's no healthcare. Life expectancies dropped to the early 50s. And, you know, these abductions have been going on by, you know, the Nigerians call them bandits, these criminal gangs. They normally target people on highways who are driving or villagers, you know, demanding higher and higher ransoms. But security is barely non-existent in the region. And people are getting absolutely desperate. It's definitely a test for Tinubu. He's just been in power for about a year. But there's kind of no prospect, I think, for the military or the forces that he's deployed to really do anything long term unless there's just mass radical change coming from the government.
Okay, a breath from all that. We have to move some of the news of the world to the side for a moment because we're going to make sure that we use our guest to talk about something extremely important that I know you've been waiting for out of London. A lot of us this week have been asking the question, what was she thinking? A doctored photo of the Princess of Wales, Kate Middleton, released this week and setting off a PR firestorm. The photo showing Kate with her three children in honor of Mother's Day in the UK. It was taken down by several photo agencies after it was determined that she had been the image had been substantially edited and manipulated. That's called a kill notice. If you ever wondered what the term kill notice means, that's it. Take the photo down. This photo has fueled conspiracy theories around the princess's whereabouts. She hasn't been seen in public, I'll remind you, since December. In January, Kensington Palace announced that the princess had undergone abdominal surgery and likely wouldn't return to public life until after Easter, which is 2 weeks from Sunday. The princess, Kate, apologized on social media on Monday for any, quote, confusion that she may have caused. I need to know theories from each of you. Nina, you in particular, you're in London. Start us off. Where is Kate? Your best theories, please.
You're going to have to forgive a rant. I am sorry. I'm just
why I came to you first.
The eyeballs. I mean, the upshot is that Britain is still talking about it. The conspiracy theories have been, you know, swirling all week. You know, over her whereabouts. You've just asked the question, where is she? Over the scale of her surgery. Has she even had surgery? Perhaps she's actually died. You know, was it really Kate in the car with William up and about? Or was it a stand-in? Was the photo from October? was the photo from a Vogue shoot in 2016. So without wanting to propagate the conspiracy theories, I've really had it up to here. And if you're Kate, it's been pretty devastating. She's worked her entire royal adult life to stay away from controversy. And, you know, you could argue, of course, that in a world in which, you know, AI and manipulated photographs, you know, lead to questions of authenticity and reality and truth. But really, does the British public have a right to know, you know, about her medical condition? Do we really, you know, we just seem to not be able to leave her alone. And of course, the kind of self-righteousness of the British media, you know, on the one hand, attacking her all of last week. And then this week, you know, all of the kind of questions about, oh, you know, Kate's clearly had enough, you know, we risk alienating her, she's going to have to retreat. It's just unbearable. And that, I'm going to end on that. I cannot say anymore.
Nina has had quite enough. Amy, you are also a royal subject. I'm sorry for calling you that if you don't like the label, but you are, whether you like it or not. What's your take on where is Kate, but also the impact of this celebrity ridiculousness on the culture?
I think in this era of deep partisan divides, I think this has been a beautiful moment of really coming together. And in a time where, you know, Twitter is really not what it once was, or X, I guess, it has been a beautiful resurgence in just like insanity on Twitter, which I've been enjoying this week. I have no idea where Kate Middleton is. I mean, she's a mother of three. I hope she's having a nap somewhere.
Is it medical? Is it family strife? Is it marital problems? Is it something that public hasn't been apprised of?
I think this has been, they've handled this very poorly. I mean, in a vacuum, you know, people will fill the void with speculation. Nobody knows that better than the royal family. I'm of the view that they are entitled to a degree of privacy, but if this is a medical issue which is so severe that she can't be seen in public for almost 3 months, I think the public deserves to know what's going on. And as Lloyd Austin did here when he had his cancer, there's an education opportunity if she is, you know, undergoing some kind of serious issue.
Alex, nobody knows better than the royals how easy it is to step into scandal, how tabloids drive scandal, what happens if you don't manage the message. I don't know where Kate is. I frankly hope she's fine. Should have known. Should have not ever stepped in this.
Well, I know exactly where Kate is. She's in all of our collective conscience. Like
living rent-free.
Living rent-free. Look, what this scandal really does, if you even want to call it that, what this really tells us is no one trusts anything anymore. There was a time where you could trust the royals when they put something out. Now you've got amateur and professional sleuths looking at Mother's Day photos to see if there's lies in it. And granted, they found some, but that doesn't take away from the fact that, like, now even the most trusted sources can no longer just put out things without scrutiny. This is the era we're in, and the royals should have known.
Last word from the national security reporter from Politico there, Alex Ward. All right, before we end some news about the world under the sea. In Australia, the famed coral reefs of the Great Barrier Reef are facing unprecedented bleaching, in some spots, fatal stress. Water temperature data suggests that the toll could approach that of 2016, when about 30% of the reef's coral died after suffering through what were then unprecedented levels of heat stress. But there is good news. About 2,000 miles northeast, scientists studying coral restoration in Indonesia have found that artificially restored coral reefs can regrow as fast as naturally occurring reefs just 4 years after initial transplantation. Apart from the natural beauty, reef growth is super important. It keeps up with sea level rise, protects coastlines from storms and erosion, and provides a habitat for very important reef animals. So, good news. From under the sea, I want to thank our panelists, Amy McKinnon, National Security and Intelligence Reporter at Foreign Policy, Nina Maria Potts of Feature Story News, and Alex Ward of Politico, author of National Security Daily and author of The Internationalists. Thank you all for joining us. Mike Kidd is our sound designer and engineer with help from Kellen Quigley, Kennedy Wright, and Adrian Danhauser. Chris Castano is our digital editor. Maya Garg is our senior managing producer. AC Faldez is our senior supervising producer. Amanda Williams is our special projects editor. Aileen Humphreys is the editor and producer of 1A On Demand with help this week from Arfi Getty. And Barbara Anguiano produces our podcast with help this week from Lauren Hamilton. This program comes to you not from under the sea, but from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Stay afloat. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Macmillan Audio. One of the most thought-provoking books about the Middle East, Thomas L. Friedman's From Beirut to Jerusalem, is now available as an unabridged audiobook featuring a new preface read by the author. Find it wherever audiobooks are sold. Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Online. Is your child asking questions on their homework you don't feel equipped to answer? IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. One subscription gets you everything. One site for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And NPR listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
What does it mean to be Black in America? In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as the Black experience, you'll hear it means everything. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.